My name is Arden Fleming and I'm 15 years old. Today is October 23rd, 2017, and I'm speaking with Agneta Voulier, who's my grandma on my mom's side. And we're recording this interview over FaceTime with her in Wellfleet, Massachusetts, and me in Mint Hill, North Carolina. All right, Nana, I have some questions set out. It's okay if the conversation switches up. But my first question was, to the best of your knowledge, because I know it gets messy, what's our family heritage?
What? I would have to get the family tree out to really discuss it.
I know, but just what you remember.
By heritage, what do you mean?
By...
You mean like, where are your ancestors from?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, I know that the real origins, let's see, it is messy, you're right, in part to complain. Okay, on my father's side of the family, his father was Swiss, and his mother was half Egyptian and half French. That's my father, your
great
grandfather. Oh, right.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Oh, that's right, because I'm your grandmother. So that's your great grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-oh, you're all pixelated. How come you're all pixelated? Yes, he was, so his mother was half French and half Egyptian.
Mm-hmm.
So your great-grandmother's, no, that would be your great-great-grandmother, right? His mother.
Yes.
Is your great-great-grandmother. Okay. Confusing. His mom, being your great-great-grandmother, was half Egyptian and half French. And his father, your great-great-grandfather, was Swiss. As far as I know, all Swiss, but I may not really know enough. But he died when my father was young.
Mm-hmm.
On my mother's side, I know not much. I know my mother was born in Germany. She was a German. And, but she was raised in her childhood in Switzerland, in Geneva, and then ended up in Paris at around age 15, 16, and lived in Paris until she came to the United States during the war.
Mm-hmm.
You need to know when she was born?
I don't need specific dates.
Okay. Yeah.
And were there any...
And I actually, you know, my father wrote us, except I think the family story, I'd have to dig it up, because he did kind of write us a story about our family.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that there's more in there that might be of use to you.
Okay.
Except, yeah.
All
right. So that's your heritage from my side.
Yes. Were there any family traditions that were passed down from your family?
From my family, no, not that really I can think of. I mean, we did Christmas on Christmas Eve.
Mm-hmm.
We never did Thanksgiving, because that was not, that's an American holiday that doesn't exist in Europe. And I'm not too sure what you mean by traditions. I think Wellfleet, if anything, would have been a tradition, things like always going barefoot in the summer.
Well, I mean, we put candles on our Christmas tree.
Oh, that's a tradition.
Yeah,
yeah, that you got from our family,
mm-hmm.
and that was always true.
Yeah.
And we always celebrated Christmas Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Birthdays didn't matter very much. We certainly never had birthday parties. They were, I mean, your birthday was acknowledged, but it wasn't like your friends were going to come over and share it with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you could say that was a tradition, to not have a tradition. And what are the kinds of traditions? Definitely candles on the tree is for sure. It, at Christmas time also, we tended to have duck for our Christmas meal. And we always went to St. Patrick's Church, usually for the Christmas Eve service, and we would light candles at St. Patrick's. But I really can't think of much in terms of it. It was much harder to have family traditions because since I'm first generation in this country, they weren't really, you know, past whatever traditions kind of got cut off, I think.
Yeah. Well, then I guess that goes to my next question, which was, what was it like living here with both of your parents not being from here?
Well, they both had accents. Everybody identified us as being the little French kids, for sure. I know that my first language was French, and that once we started going to school, we were sort of, we wanted to mostly speak English, and we were kind of, you know, like a lot of kids, sort of not wanting to acknowledge the French part, wanting to just be more American.
Yeah.
I think Al was more that way than me. But other than the fact that I was well aware of the accents, and I guess it was more subtle things that were part of my life that were clearly different because my parents were European versus if I had been an American kid. Well, one thing for sure, there was never any ketchup in the house, ever. And we weren't allowed to chew gum. And soda was practically unheard of. And we always had a lot of cheese, and they were always like the, you know, the kind of cheese that you get at the cheese market. We made trips in a cab to specifically go where, in this little shop that had cheese from floor to ceiling. The cheese was very important. I would have to say that the food that we ate clearly made us know that we were from European stock versus the American traditions.
Yeah.
And we never did Easter. Well, we did paint eggs. That's not entirely true. We did paint eggs.
Bless you.
But, yeah. But, you know. And.
Bless you.
I think I was more surrounded with European, I don't know, artifacts, and people my parents knew tended to be European or certain not American. So that was a lot of the influences. I didn't have a lot of the all-American normal things growing up. American kids would have.
So what did your parents do, like, for a living? Because I know Grandmama started out as a model in Paris, but then what happened when they moved over?
Well, she gave up modeling before she came to the States anyhow, because she actually really didn't, even though she was a famous model at the time, and, you know, famous people photographed her and all that. She did not like being a model. She felt she was a bit ahead of her time. She objected to it because it made her feel like merchandise in a way.
Yeah.
You know, she was objectified.
Mm-hmm.
And she really, you know, she was a feminist, and it definitely had an edge to it that she disliked.
Yeah.
And so she gravitated to the photography side of being a model. So she photographed models, and then she took up generally photography. I think she found that far more interesting and challenging mm-hmm. than just being a clothes horse that other people kind of, you know, were always like gawking at you kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so she gravitated to photography, and when she came to the United States, and at that point my father had already opened up Baccarat,
mm-hmm.
then she started photographing Baccarat crystal, which I hear tell is very challenging to photograph crystal well.
Yeah.
Because of reflections
mm-hmm.
and stuff. And so I think she was actually quite gifted. And her photographs were what appeared in all the ads for Baccarat in the New Yorker. They were always in the New Yorker. And, you know, the high-end magazines had ads for Baccarat, and those were my mother's photographs. So that's what my mother did.
Mm-hmm.
And my father, he had a rather varied career. He was educated as a lawyer, and as far as I know, I don't think he really ever practiced law, because I don't think he really liked law.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that he came to the United States, and he did several things prior to setting things up to have Baccarat be in the United States. My father's responsible for the fact that Baccarat crystal came to the United States. But before the Baccarat part, I know that he, for a while, he was something of a radio commentator who commented on a Frenchman's impressions of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his big stories was the first time he ever went to a baseball game and what kind of an impression that made on him. And I believe he wrote for the Washington Post.
Wow.
Yeah. And he also, that was at the very beginning. During the war, there were two things he did. He ran the French Information Center in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also a Swiss citizen, and that qualified him as a Swiss neutral, to be, he was hired by the YMCA.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how it worked with the YMCA, but that's who hired him to go to the prisoner of war camps in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
To be sure that all the camps that were here were adhering properly to the rules of the Geneva Convention for prisoners, the rules for prisoners as outlined in the Geneva Convention, which is humane treatment and, you know, various other things. So he traveled the United States a lot and made connections with the prisoners and with the people that ran the camps. And he made friends on both sides of that, and saw to it that the prisoners were, you know, getting treated correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the war, for a spell, he went back. The whole family went back to Europe to live. I think they were thinking that maybe they were going to live in Europe,
mm-hmm.
or but maybe they were just feeling it out. I'm not sure. But he went back to write something of a book again, through for the YMCA about the experience as the person who went to the prisoner of war camps. Sort of tallying it all up. It was very, kind of a methodical rendering. It wasn't a story. I mean, it somewhat made a story, but it had a lot more to do with supplies and demand and, you know, everything he did to fulfill his mission. Mm-hmm. And then later, he then was requested by my godfather, who had a controlling interest in Baccarat, mm-hmm. if he would set up shop in New York City in order for Baccarat Crystal to have an opening in the United States. So that's how he got a shop. He bought a building in New York City on 57th Street. Is a very fancy street, mm-hmm. and he brought Baccarat to, that was the showroom, and from there he spent the better part of my childhood traveling the country and opening up accounts in all of the fancy stores across the United States so that they would have Baccarat crystal. So he was, I don't know what you would have called him, he was a salesman of sorts, but he was also pretty much the president of Baccarat Crystal in the United States.
So he traveled a lot. Do you think that kind of, like, how do you think your relationship with your parents
affected my childhood?
What? So how do you think your relationship with your parents kind of affected you as a person? Because if he was traveling a lot throughout your childhood, do you think that...
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, then that... And my mother often traveled with him. Mm-hmm. Well, they were boarding school at the age... My very school experience was at the age of five, mm-hmm. because they went off to travel, as part of all this, they traveled. And my mother wanted to be included because she liked the, it was fashionable, she could be fashionable, she met all the important people, and she, you know, mm-hmm. wanted to be part of that presentation, the team as mm-hmm. well. So the fact that he traveled and she also traveled a good deal sort of necessitated that we go be in boarding school. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was five, that was a brief stint. That was for, I think, maybe 2 months or something. I'm really not sure quite how long it was. Mm-hmm. And then we came back home. But by the age of seven, I was in boarding school steadily. Mm-hmm. So, in many ways, I really actually didn't see that much of my parents.
Yeah. Do you think...
Initially, every weekend, we would come home.
Yeah.
Unless they were traveling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I didn't see too much of them.
So, do you think you not having a huge relationship with your, like, not seeing them that much and being kind of on your own in boarding school? Do you think that's what made you so independent later on?
Oh, yes, absolutely. No question mm-hmm. about it. I learned to negotiate many things on my own and how to maneuver. I mean, for starters, anyway, even at, you know, when we were home, my parents really didn't supervise us. When I was, when we were going to school in New York City, we walked to school on our own every day and walked home, and it was as much as 10 blocks away. I mean, you just went out and you just, you know, it came naturally.
Yeah.
Because we were essentially unsupervised.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we were expected to behave. We weren't hooligans, but we were not supervised. Yeah. And certainly going to boarding school, and even the fact that you took a train to boarding school and all that, definitely made me independent. Yeah.
Yeah. So who do you think your biggest inspirations were growing up? Did you have any teacher at your boarding school that maybe influenced you
absolutely.
The most?
Absolutely. Yeah. There were several people. One was a man who was like a mentor to me. He actually was my parents' age.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, he might even have been a bit older than my parents, but right around that anyway. He was very grown, you know. And he was a painter. And he took me on walks. We went walking together.
Mm-hmm.
So I considered him a very important person in my life, mostly because he treated me very much like a grown-up.
Mm-hmm.
So he was important, and in terms of my teachers, yes, there were a few that were really important, but the most important one was my art teacher at Manumit. Mm-hmm. Manumit was very important. In my first boarding school was a Catholic, my real boarding, first real boarding school was Catholic, like a Catholic convent. And I don't have any favorite people from that. I have, they were very strict. It was really kind of an awful place.
Mm-hmm.
So that one was a wash. But the one afterwards was my school called Manumit, which I loved dearly because it was so different from the Catholic convent school. It was a progressive school.
Mm-hmm.
And in that school, was my very favorite teacher of all time, and he was my art teacher, and his name was Norman Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
And he too had the gift of treating me. He just had a way of making me feel acknowledged.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, he really liked my artwork, and that really helped. I had fun with him, and I felt very free.
Mm-hmm.
So he was definitely one, a big one there. There was another teacher there called Ted Hemberger, who was a very kind man. I had a couple of kind ones. Manumit had lots of nice people, really, and so that was great. And then when I had to leave Manumit and go to another school, a whole different kind of school again, very different. This one was an academically achieving school, and Manumit was not particularly that at all. It was a freedom school.
Mm-hmm.
But it fostered creativity. The academic achieving school had good teachers who were very interested in teaching you, and I can remember any number of them. I remember my geometry teacher, and I loved geometry, and my chemistry teacher, Frank Gamarotti, and Doc Washburn was my geometry teacher, and I had an English teacher called Gordon Day, who was also very good and inspired me to write. And those are the three teachers from that school that I remember the most. And of course, I did also have an art teacher, Mrs. McCook, but she didn't excite me and make me really happy with art the way Norman did. So that was that school.
So you finished school with two kids on your own.
I finished high school that way, mm-hmm. Yes.
So how do you think you managed to do all of that by yourself?
I don't know. You never know all those things until you just look back and go, wow. I was determined. I mean, clearly I was determined. It didn't faze me. I just knew I needed an education. That mm-hmm. was clear. And that was probably very European influence that, of course, I had to have an education. So mm-hmm. even if my life was generally interrupted by having kids and all that, it wasn't, it never occurred to me that it would stop me from getting an education. So you know, I had to just do what I needed to do. So I actually finished my high school in night school. I went to night school after I was married. Mm-hmm. And I definitely, yes, by the time I graduated, I had both two babies. And you know, Bob was started college, and I basically, even though I had the two babies, I wrote a lot of his papers. I was, you know, because he had to work, too.
Yeah.
So, and then I was very lucky because, again, I had a teacher, again, an art teacher, who really liked, knowing I wanted an education, what I did was I signed up for some art classes at the University of Louisville, but you could, I forget what you call it when you not actually, you're taking classes but not for grades. There's a name for, I don't know why, I keep always forgetting what that's called. So you can sign up for a class, but you're not really enrolled in the college, but you're just taking the class. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and in art. And the art teacher liked me so well that later he became the head of the department, and he basically saw to it that I was granted a full scholarship to go to the university as an art student.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, on a silver platter. And I think he thought that he was astounded that with two kids married that I still wanted to take art classes and that I was determined enough and therefore I deserved an education. Mm-hmm. So he saw to it that I had a full scholarship. I didn't even try for that. It was like handed to me. So that got me, really, it's opened the doors for me to get a college education. Mm-hmm. And even though I didn't finish at the University of Louisville, I finished getting a degree in fine art, my you know, bachelor's of fine arts at Western Washington State College. So there was no question in my mind ever whether or not I would finish school.
Yeah.
It was going to be come hell or high water, I would finish school. And it took me many years.
Yeah.
Because it was art, which takes twice as long anyway, and because, of course, I had kids. But I did finish. Mm-hmm. And then when I was finished, I discovered that I wasn't ever going to earn my keep as an artist because I had two kids, so now I needed a career. Mm-hmm. And that's when I moved into nursing.
Yeah. So kind of moving on from what happened and more kind of how you feel about it, but how does it make you feel to have seen a lot of progress be made in the world, especially on your own, with fighting so much for your own rights, with your work? How does it feel to see kind of how the world has changed from since you were my age to where you are now?
Well, it feels conflicted.
Mm-hmm.
Because on many levels, it has made great progress. So that I could say things to you that would blow you away, like, really, it was like that?
Mm-hmm.
That even has changed even almost too recently. I mean, when you think that the Equal Rights Amendment isn't even ratified in every state for women, that kind of thing. And yet, you know, the pay scale has gotten way better, even if it's not quite even yet. But so there has been much progress. I mean, when I first started getting, for instance, my property taxes in California, mm-hmm. and I bought the property in the 80s, like 87, It would say Agneta Vuillet, an unmarried woman. I mean, that seems crazy, right, to you?
Yeah.
Right. That was in the 80s. And when I was in my, in my 20s and right through late, a woman was not allowed to get credit in her own name. She had to have, it had to be in her husband's name, and he had to grant permission for her to have her own credit card. Mm-hmm. Things like that don't exist anymore. So that's real progress. And of course, I definitely remember many of the fights, you know, especially the fight for the right to have abortions and, mm-hmm. you know, but now even like racism, where I thought that we were way more advanced than we are regarding race relations.
Yeah.
And it's sort of coming up, so like, oh my God, we're not nearly as advanced as I had assumed. Mm-hmm. And I would have to say a bit of that is true with the way I see women's role and the advances that seemingly we made and thought that we would be building on at this point almost look like they're in jeopardy.
Yeah.
And my fear and my conflict comes with the fact that you young women now so take for granted what seems like your rights, mm-hmm. that you're not going to be vigilant enough to be on top of it if they slip out from under you.
Yeah.
Because you didn't have to fight for them, or not even aware of the fight that took place, mm-hmm. for you to have them. And let's see what else. This is stupid. But a difference is, like, I don't know. I certainly dress has changed quite a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, in my day, women still wore gloves. You know, mm-hmm. In my early time, they wore gloves and stockings and heels. Mm-hmm. But you never wore heels with pants because that was considered low class look, like something cheap. And now it's the standard. You know, lots of things like that.
Yep.
Are strange and weird.
So these two kind of go together, but if you could change one thing about the world, what would it be? And if you could see one thing happen in your lifetime, what do you think it would be?
Oh my, that's the kind of a question that I would think about and go and wish I had answered differently after I'm mm-hmm. done answering it, because I can't think clearly enough to answer it well. Mm-hmm. It's one thing. I mean, my Lord, there'd be so many probably, but one thing that I would wish to see happen, and what was the other one thing?
If you would wish to see happen, and another one is, what would change, maybe? So it kind of goes together. So,
oh my God. I mean, what I would wish to see happen would be some real utopian wish, which really would be that, you know, that of the wish for equality, and not just the female-male mm-hmm. equality, but across the board equality for us. I would really like to see us humans wake up our eyes to the blessings of the earth, mm-hmm. and our, you know, to treat each other with dignity and treat the earth with dignity, mm-hmm. real dignity and real oh gosh, I have a hard time finding the word for it, but a real sense of awe, and beyond the awe of it, but to be able to, in some manner, worship what we have. You know, I definitely, it's like, where do you draw the line with that wish and acknowledging? I guess I would really want to see mankind wise up. That would be, if you put it in a nutshell, let's wise up in every possible way that wisdom could manifest. That would be my wish for the world. And if that happened, then we would drop away an awful lot of what really makes us so stupid.
And this is kind of to wrap it up, because we don't have much time on this recording left, but
okay,
if you could leave a message or phrase for me to remember you by, what would it be?
Ay, ay, ay.
These are the deep questions.
How about that one? Ay, ay, ay.
Ay, ay, ay.
Never forget it.
Honest to Pete.
Oh, my gosh. All right. How about it's a work in progress?
It's a good one.
And don't forget, you can always, everything can always improve.
That is true.
Yeah. So that is that, you know, enough, or should I come up with more wisdom quick?
That's enough wisdom for me then.
Yeah. Yeah, just hang on the aye, 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 and it's a work in progress. I'll think of many more, I'm sure. I'll have to make sure I leave all that for you in my will, in my last testament.
Yes.
Some kind of a recording for my kiddos.
I'll write it out and get it framed.
Yeah. Yeah. Wise up.
Wise up.
Wise up. That'll never get old. And I think I'd also, especially for your 20s, and this is for you and for Leif as my grandchildren, and what I really want you to know and keep in mind, that the 20s are very turbulent. And to not large, and that it does get better. Because you get better perspective. You want so much for yourself. You have such expectations. You have so many wishes to succeed. And there's a lot of anxiety that goes with how all that will take shape. And I never want you to, like, get carried away with how hard it seems and the emotional turmoil that goes with all of that. And somehow to keep the perspective alive that growing up is a lot like the weather. Every time you hit the big storms that seem like they're gonna snow you under, it's like the weather. It will change and get better, and the sun will come out and all that, and that the 30s, you know, I just know how hard the 20s are. And even, you know, by the 30s a little better, and by the 40s you're much more accepting. And gosh, by the time you reach my age, it's like, oh, well. But you still got to remember there's always room for improvement, and it's always a work in progress. Even at my age, you got to keep working on everything that could be better, including yourself.
Can always wise up.
And always wise up. So there.
There.
Don't forget that in your 20s, because you're going to have some dark times, and think of Nana.
I will.
Because I had some very dark times. Very, very dark times. And I just would never wish them on you. Even though they're bound to happen. So. And, you know, that can't go in the archives, right? We're past the archives.
Well, I can that's end
just,
it now.
That's just me talking to you.
All right. Well, yeah. End this. I'll still talk to you, but I'm ending the recording now.
Oh!
Yep. There's a limit on this thing. But, alright, well, thank you for doing this with me. Because it's good to have it on a recording.
Yeah. Now I may never get out of my chair. I have to take things to Al's house. And, So, does this mean you have to stay up late tonight?
No.
Okay. Good.
No, I'll be fine.
Good. And how's Doodle?
Doodle's good. I think he's calmed down a little bit more since the college application thing has passed, the early applications, because he waited too long on that one.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's one of those big lessons, you know, that will follow you all your life. That's definitely one of those work in progress things. I'm getting better.
I know you are. Now we got to work on your grandson.